WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening today. Hope your Thanksgiving is going to be a great one when we get there in a couple of days. Coming up later this hour, will the gay marriage bill pass in New Jersey before Corzine leaves office at the end of the year? Incoming Governor Christie won't sign it. And are we headed for an internet where websites either turn up in your searches on Google or Bing, but not on both? We will get details of a proposal being discussed by Microsoft and the owners of the Wall Street Journal, which could start that process in motion. But right now, the world's best-known Darwinist is here to celebrate the 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species. Charles Darwin's breakthrough book was published November 24th, 1859. Dawkins' own recent book is called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. He is professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. And Professor Dawkins, always a pleasure. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
And how about this? Let's not spend most of our time responding to the creationists.
Yes, what a good idea.
You and I have done a few shows like that in the last couple of years. Let's talk about history and science, which is really much more interesting. You're up for that? Good. When we're celebrating the origin of species, what are we really celebrating? What happened 150 years ago today?
Darwin published the book, The Origin of Species. The idea had actually been published a year earlier in 1858 at the Linnean Society, jointly by Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, neither of whom were present at the meeting, but their papers were read out. The idea fell flat in 1858. People just didn't get it. And it took the book, The Origin of Species, which was published a year later, this day a year later, for people to really get the point. And Thomas Henry Huxley, for example, said on closing the book, how extremely stupid of me not to have thought of that.
What was the point that people didn't get in 1858?
The point was that the complexity of life and the illusion of design that life shows doesn't need a designer. It's a very powerful illusion of design, but it can come about by the ordinary laws of physics from simple beginnings. That was the huge discovery that Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace made.
It sounds like a case against religion, per se, when you frame it that way.
Well, that wouldn't be the interpretation of, say, a bishop or a cardinal or a vicar. They would say that it was just God's way of doing it. And as we said, we're not going to talk about religion. But it certainly did completely destroy the argument from design, which said that God is demonstrated by the organization, the beauty, the complexity, and the apparent design of living things.
Did it take a next logical step from the science that had come before, or was it a bolt from the blue?
Well, there had been straws in the wind before. The idea of evolution itself was not new. Even the idea of natural selection was not new. But it was Darwin and Wallace who really put them together and showed that they could explain the whole of life. These were not just small little piddling ideas. This was a gigantic idea that completely revolutionized human thought.
How did Darwin come up with the theory? Probably people who haven't studied it all that much in school or whatever have this vague notion of observing the blue-footed boobies in the Galapagos, you know, and that's about it. How did he do it?
It did not come as a bolt from the blue for Darwin. He gradually became aware that the evidence more and more supported the idea that species change into other species. And then later he got the idea of the driving mechanism, which he called natural selection. He got that idea in 1838 when he was back in England And he got it from reading Robert Malthus, whose treatise on population emphasized competition and the struggle for survival.
So Malthus, to some degree, begot Darwin.
Yes, Malthus, interestingly, begat both Darwin and Wallace independently, because Wallace and Darwin had the idea independently. And in both cases, we know from their own accounts, both Darwin and Wallace got the idea from, not directly from Malthus. Malthus certainly didn't have the idea of evolution by natural selection, but they were both inspired to think about the importance of competition and overcrowding.
So, listeners, we have time for phone calls for Richard Dawkins today on this 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. And as I said, let's not make this about creationists versus evolutionary biologists, but any question you want to ask about the science of evolution, or particularly Charles Darwin and his life and work, Richard Dawkins is here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Did Darwin write for an expert scientific audience or for the general population?
So he wrote for the general public, but it's one of those books that both enlightened his scientific colleagues and the general public. So his target was the intelligent general public, the educated general public. But as I quoted earlier, it came as a surprise to many of his scientific colleagues as well.
So a little like your title, he was into the public understanding of science.
Yes, he was, but he was also into changing the minds of fellow scientists, as indeed am I suppose.
And the original full title of the book was, if I have this right, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life.
Yes.
In what sense did he use the word races in
that
title?
That's a very interesting question. He most certainly did not use it in the sense that we use it as black races, white races, Chinese races, and so on like that. What race meant to Darwin, and indeed to Wallace, was all those individuals who possessed a certain hereditary characteristic. Nowadays we would say possessed a certain gene, although the word gene wasn't in existence then. So if you take, say, a population of butterflies, and some of them have spots and some of them don't have spots, and natural selection favors the ones who have spots for some reason, that would be what Darwin meant by a favored race in this case. So it doesn't mean a race in the sense of a geographically separate population. That's a very unfortunate misunderstanding, which in a way was asking to happen.
Do you have a favorite Darwin story, meaning from his research, something that he observed that led to an aha moment that you find particularly inspiring or instructive?
Well, when he was on the Galapagos Islands, which you mentioned earlier, it wasn't actually the blue-footed boobies, I think, that inspired him, but the mockingbirds. He noticed that the mockingbirds were a bit different on each of the islands. They were more different from those on the mainland of South America, but they were a bit different on each of the islands, and that began to give him the idea, as did the Galapagos finches. And he said something like, one could almost imagine that one species had been taken, meaning one species from the mainland, had been taken and modified on each of the different islands. He used that phrase, modified, used that word, modified. And that was one of the beginnings of the inklings that Darwin got.
Did it spark a religious versus scientific debate right away, the publication of the book?
Not in a simple way, not in a straightforward way, because there were clergymen such as Charles Kingsley who immediately accepted it. They read The Origin of Species and immediately accepted that this has got to be right, and as well they might, because the evidence was overwhelming even then. It's even more overwhelming now. But they interpreted it as God's way of doing things. So it wasn't a universal war between science and religion that was sparked.
With all that science has discovered since 1859, what did Darwin get wrong? Anything?
Mostly genetics. He didn't know about DNA, obviously. Nobody knew that DNA was, how DNA worked until after 1953. But he also got genetics wrong in a bigger way than that, because he, along with just about everybody else in Victorian times, thought that heredity was a blending process. I mean, obviously, individuals inherit from both their mother and their father, and people thought that we were a kind of mixture, almost like a chemical mixture, like mixing two substances together, of maternal and paternal factors. And it was pointed out in Darwin's time that if that were true, natural selection couldn't work, and that bothered Darwin. The answer to it came in the 20th century. Actually, it came in the 19th century with Gregor Mendel, but nobody understood that at the time. In the 20th century, it was fully understood that genetics is a digital process, and so there is no problem with the variation disappearing, as was argued in 19th century times. So Darwin, everything that Darwin said about genetics was wrong, and it's remarkable how right he got everything else.
You mentioned Mendel. We have a caller asking a question about Mendel. Mike, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, Professor Dawkins. Mendel was obviously contemporaneous, and I wonder, was there any exchange, and were they aware of each other's work? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Mendel was aware of Darwin. Darwin was unfortunately not aware of Mendel. It's a great pity, because if Darwin had been aware of Mendel, the science of evolution would have been advanced by many decades. We know that Mendel was aware of Darwin because in the library of the monastery where Mendel was abbot, in what's now the Czech Republic, there is a German edition of The Origin of Species which contains underlinings that are almost certainly Mendel's.
Dan in Marine Park, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins on the 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species. Hello.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure how to phrase this, but I'm just curious. I know that life seems to evolve spontaneously, and they're searching for life in other extraterrestrial planets and systems and such. And I was just wondering, and maybe it's not answerable, but does the professor think that intelligent life, like such as man, is that like a very rare aberration? Or do you think that would be a normal evolutionary step in the evolutionary process?
Well, it's not a step in the evolutionary process because it happened before evolution began. But it's a very interesting question about whether it's a very rare event. We don't have any direct evidence bearing upon that, so it has to be, to a large extent, guesswork. One could say that almost however rare, almost however improbable the origin of life was, the number of planets in the universe is so gigantic that it would be surprising if there were not life elsewhere in the universe. But it might also be that the life in the universe is spread out on islands that are so far apart that each island of life has no opportunity ever to know about the others, which is rather a sad thought. But we have no direct evidence. The only thing we can say is that we have never yet been visited either by living creatures from extraterrestrial planets or by radio signals, which is, of course, far more probable if they've developed technology. And so all we can say is we haven't been visited, so life can't, at least technologically advanced life, can't be all that frequent. There can't be any more, you know, within a reasonable radius of Earth, or we would have heard about it.
But I think in Dan's question there's also a notion of inevitability, or a question about inevitability of the progress of evolution. Was it inevitable once the process began that it would lead to more or less who we are and then whatever we're becoming?
Well, that's another very interesting question, and we can get slight insights into that sort of question by looking at independent evolutions. We can't look at independent evolutions of life because all life forms, as far as we know, on this planet came from one common ancestor, some kind of protobacterium. But we can say that the mammals of Australia, for example, which are all marsupials except for a few, that the mammals of Australia, which evolved independently ever since the dinosaurs went extinct, from the mammals in Asia and from the mammals in South America, which also evolved independently from about that time, we can look at these independent evolutions of mammals and see how similar they are. And they're pretty similar. I mean, there are mammals in the Australian mammals in Australia that fairly closely resemble moles and mice and cats and rabbits and lions. They're extinct, and wolves, they're extinct. And similarly in South America. So That does suggest that there is a certain, not inevitability, but a certain predictability in the evolutionary process. But as for whether you would expect to get something like us, that's to say, creatures that walk on their hind legs with skillful hands and with big brains, it has only happened once on our planet, so it's not that probable, not that predictable. But I should have thought it's not all that unpredictable either.
The questions that Darwin was asking 150 years ago, I mean, we've come a long way since then. An article on the Nation's website today reminds us of some of the policy dilemmas posed now as we understand more about genetics. The examples they give are, can someone be held responsible for a crime if he is more genetically predisposed to violence? And what to do with repeat drug offenders with a predisposition to addiction?
Yes.
Do you have answers from your perspective as a scientist to either
really
of those questions?
Right. This is a philosophical question about the determinism and free will in a way.
Yes.
I mean, if you imagine somebody charged with a crime whose defense is, it wasn't my fault, Your Honor, it was my genes made me do it, then you don't actually have to use genes in that argument. You could say, it was my molecules made me do it, it was my environment made me do it, it's not my fault, I was brought up by a savage monster for a father or something of that sort. You can make a kind of deterministic argument if you want to get out of the blame for something. And the whole question of the blameworthiness of individuals, the extent to which we can hold individuals responsible for what they do, if they try to plead that they were impelled to do what they do by either their genes or their environment, that's a difficult philosophical, criminological, penological problem, which is not specifically a genetic question. Genetics is only one aspect of the predetermining factors that influence the way we are.
Celeste in Stamford, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hi.
Good morning. I love your show no matter what day it is.
Thank you.
Professor Dawkins, I'm going to be teaching a new course on animal ethics, and I'm looking for a book that will be something that I can add to the reading list that I'm trying to assemble right now that won't be Darwin's tome, but something else that might be easy to read and grabbable by my college-level students. Do you have any suggestions?
And do you accept the premise that ethics have developed in species other than humans?
Well,
Professor?
I'm not sure whether the questioner is asking me to recommend a book on animal ethics or on evolution.
You're looking...
Okay. I'm looking possibly for something that might blend them both, and I really don't know what is really available out there that might blend them. I thought you might have some favorites that you think when you hand them to students, they sit there and really love them.
By animal ethics, do you mean the ethics of the way we treat animals?
Yes, as well, because if our source is truly from the animals, then how we treat them is representative of how we think of ourselves in many ways.
Okay. Well, the Bible of the animal liberation movement is Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. That's widely regarded as rather extreme, although it seems to me to be very logical. My ex-wife, Marion Stamp Dawkins, wrote a rather good book on animal suffering. And let me think, what else? Mark Hauser has written a nice book on the evolutionary origins of psychological predispositions to be ethical. So those
Celeste,
are three that I can think of.
Good luck. Professor Dawkins, do you know about the new book by Nicholas Wade called The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures? This is as close as we're going to get to the religion versus evolution question. But as summarized in the New York Times today, his book argues that the urge to faith evolved to its strong position today through natural selection because religion conferred advantages in early civilization. Do you know this book or that theory?
Well, I think that's a perfectly plausible thing to suggest, and I suggested it myself in my previous book, The God Delusion.
Uh-huh.
Religious impulse is so universal, not among individuals, but among cultures all around the world, that it does seem to need an explanation in the same kind of way as, say, sexual lust needs an explanation. And I think you can think of various explanations of an evolutionary kind. But one thing it's very important to grasp is that because something has an evolutionary explanation, it doesn't mean it's correct. because there's an evolutionary reason why people believe in supernatural gods or spirits or imaginary friends, that doesn't mean that those imaginary friends exist. It merely means that, human brains have a predisposition to believe in them, and we can think of good reasons why that should be so.
Can you think of other examples where natural selection has led us to believe in things that are false or to...
Oh, yes. There's quite good evidence that nearly everybody thinks they're better than average, which obviously they can't all be right. So that if you take something like, do you think you're shorter than average, about average in height, or taller than average, most people think they're, so to speak, taller than they really are. Most people think they're better drivers than they most people think they're better drivers than average. Which
and there's an evolutionary reason for this bias?
Well, it's been suggested that there's a general reason why it's a good thing to overestimate your own ability, to give you a bit more confidence, to make you a little bit better at surviving if you are biased, if you're somewhat biased in the direction of overestimating your abilities, your capacities, rather than underestimating them.
Bill in Midwood is going to get our last question. We have a minute left, so Bill, right to the point.
Okay, I'd like to know if there's the same opposition to evolution, the idea of evolution, in Britain as there is in the U.S.
Aha, since you teach at Oxford, can you do a cross-cultural comparison?
What was the question about opposition?
Is there, yes, opposition to the idea of evolution?
There's not as much opposition here, and unfortunately there's an increasing amount of opposition, mainly coming from Islamic sources, which are a relatively new feature of British culture.
The world's best-known Darwinist, probably, Richard Dawkins, has been with us to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, November 24th, 1859. Dawkins' own recent book is called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, and this has been such a great pleasure to have you on this day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, will the gay marriage bill pass in New Jersey before Corzine leaves office, since Christie won't sign it? And the cableization of the internet, are we going to head soon for a world where your searches on Google only turn up certain things that have contracts with Google, and your searches on Bing only turn up other things, and things like that? Stay with us.